So welcome to the Passion of Real Life Legends. Again, my name is Janet Atwood. I'm the cover editor for Healthy, Wealthy, and Wise magazine, as well as the author of The Passion Test, Discovering Your Personal Secrets to Living a Life on Fire. As many of you know, our Passion series is designed to allow you to hear from people who have been incredibly successful at discovering and living their passion so you can learn from their lessons, so you can be more effective in discovering and living your own personal destiny. I think you all probably feel the same way that I do, that every one of you, I'm hoping by now we're all feeling this way, is unique, and that all of us have unique gifts which no one but each one of us can give. And our hope is that through these calls, you will begin to be more successful in giving your unique gifts to the world. Tonight we have the honor and privilege to interview number one best-selling author Debbie Ford. The recording and transcript of this call are exclusively available to our Real Life Legend Club members, as well as a free lesson from Debbie's Loving Your Life online course. If you're not yet a club member, you can listen to this call again, as well as have access to all our previous calls with people like Stephen Covey, Neil Donald Walsh, Dr. John Gray, and others by joining. And you can get all the details by going to healthywealthywise.com/elite.A as in Apple, S as in Sam, P as in Paul. Again, that's healthywealthyn.com/elite.A as in Apple, S as in Sam, P as in Paul. Now it's my pleasure and delight to introduce my co-host for tonight's call, Gay Hendricks. Gay, are you there right now?
I sure am.
All right, great. Okay, so Gay and his wife Katie are co-founders and directors of the Hendricks Institute, which teaches core skills for conscious living. And over the past 30 years, Gay and Katie have helped thousands of people open to more creativity, love, joy, and vitality through the power of conscious living and whole person learning. I encourage all of you to visit Hendricks.com, and that's spelled H-E-N-D-R-I-C-K-S, and experience, as both Chris and I have, the amazing work that they do. Gay, thank you so much for being with us tonight, and I'll turn it over to you now to introduce our wonderful guest.
Thank you very much, Janet. Well, I hope you're having a great time in Delhi, India. Well, stay well over there, okay?
All right. Thank you so much, Gay.
All right. Well, I'm very delighted that they invited me to have this conversation with Debbie today, because she is just a remarkable human being. And I'll give you her official bio here, and then I'll tell you a little bit about a couple of things I know about her personally. Debbie is an internationally recognized expert in the field of personal transformation and human potential. Many of you know her best through her big New York Times bestseller, The Dark Side of the Light Chasers, and it was the number one New York Times bestseller. It's been translated into 26 languages. She's been a guest many times on Oprah and Good Morning America, and has been on The Roseanne Show and Fox News and WNBC. She's also been featured in a lot of magazines like O Magazine and Self Magazine and USA Today. Lots of other publications like that. One of the things that I think I admire most about Debbie is how practical and yet how spiritual her answers are. She really is clear in both a spiritual sense and a very practical sense. She gives really practical coaching and also deep spiritual wisdom to people that she comes in contact with. Lots of celebrities have come to her for coaching, Alanis Morissette and Bonnie Raitt and Donna Karan and many other people. She's the founder of the Ford Institute for Integrative Coaching, which is a personal development organization that provides professional training for individuals who are committed to leading extraordinary lives. And her teachings and revolutionary inner processes have made her an internationally renowned coach, motivational speaker, and seminar leader. It's our privilege and honor to have her as our guest this evening. And one of the things I also just want to say, that I think this woman is a national, international treasure. So good evening, Debbie. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
it's a great pleasure to have a chance to talk to you. I know everyone is going to benefit from what you have to say, but it's also great for me because I jumped at the opportunity to do this because it's been a long time since I've just had an opportunity to sit down and talk to you and catch up with all the things that you're doing these days. So I'm going to benefit from this personally, too. One of the things that everybody can do is go to bestyearofyourlife.com, which is a very informative website that has to do with a lot of Debbie's latest activities. So bestyearofyourlife.com is a good place to get additional information based on what we're talking about here. So what role, Debbie, did your passions, the things that are most important to you, play in the emergence of your books?
Well, really everything. And even today, I feel that I have, my passion is to really teach people to love themselves completely and not just love the part of themselves that is lovable, like, you know, the charming, sweet, smart part, but to really love all of themselves, including their darkness. So I wrote my first book out of this passion to really share that God did create us as amazing individuals, but that we have this really similar blueprint that, within all of us, and that we all are everything, the good and the bad, the light and the dark, the sweet and the sour, the fearful and the courageous, and the dark side of the Light Chasers was really birthed out of that passion to really show people that we are all have these dark parts. We all have parts of ourselves that we feel ashamed of, we feel scared of, embarrassed by, and that we want to wish away, and that we can't wish them away because that's what it is to be a human being, but we can learn to integrate them. So that passion that exists probably more in me today, Gay, which is so interesting. Like, I'm more fascinated by what I do today than when I started, but it still drives me to do everything that I do.
Well, I think that's a sign, Debbie, that you're really on the right track as far as your work is concerned, because I know that when I'm around people like yourself that are really passionate, what it speaks to is that the work you're doing and the work you're teaching has an intrinsic validity to it and an integrity to it out of which more and more passion comes. I always tell my students that the best way to know if they're doing the right kind of work is if they feel better at the end of the day than they did when they started.
I love that, Gay. Well, it's the end of my day, and I feel like I'm just getting started.
Oh, good. Well, that lets you know you're on the right track. Well, congratulations also on getting a book to the top of the New York Times bestseller list. How did that happen, by the way?
Well, it was one of those magical moments. I always try to teach people now that, you know, there's only so much you can effort into the world. And I remember that when Dark Side Light Chasers first came out, I was sure, like many people are who write, that it would go to the top of the list and I was going to get on Oprah and everything was going to be great and easy. And I passionately went out in the world and spoke to 3 people or 7 people or 15, whoever would come and listen to me. And it really took years to finally all the pieces to just fit together because I had great people giving Oprah my book, but still nobody called. And then now I look back and I say, some things are just meant to be. And they're going to happen when they were meant to be. And I know you're an author, so you understand the Oprah desire for authors because it just, you know, propels your work out into the world. But it was just really, I feel like, a series of actual, at a time when I was surrendering, when I had given up that dream and said, okay, what do I have to do to get my work out in the world, and I'll do anything. And so I was just really working day and night to do whatever I had to do. And then, of course, a few things happened. I met Cheryl Richardson, who was being on Oprah all the time, and she's like, wow, your work is so important. What can I do to support you? Why haven't you been on Oprah? And it was interesting because she had me look at, like, why I hadn't gotten my work out in the world the way that I wanted, and what I saw is that I was scared that I would just become overwhelmed, because I was already overwhelmed with my task. And just the moment of truth of seeing that I was the one that had the blocks up, I was the one that was really scared and saying, I can't take more than I have, reminded me that I didn't really need to do anything, that if I would just surrender, God or my spirit would take care of me. And I did that, and literally 3 days later, I got called to do the Oprah show. And so I did 3 shows, and then they re-aired all 3 of them within a couple of months, and the book just, you know, shadow work went out in the world.
That's so remarkable. That's almost an identical experience. We kind of beat our brains out with our book, Conscious Loving, to get on Oprah for the first year it was out in hardback, and then the Persian Gulf War was going on, and so it didn't happen. And suddenly, a year later, when the paperback came out, literally one night we were sitting in our living room working with 6 couples, and 2 days later we were working with 10 million people on Oprah. And so you never know how those kinds of things are going to happen. But one thing I hear you speaking to, which I really appreciate, Debbie, is that you're open to both the kind of the conscious manifestation and also open to letting things happen in magical ways.
Yeah, and I think that that's the hardest part, because, right, like my and so much of what I know, Kay, just so you know, is because of you and Katie, who are both brilliant teachers.
Thank you.
But, you know, so much of the human desire is to make it happen and to think that there is, that you can do everything, that you're the driver. And really, when you give up being the driver, there's a bigger driver that's going to do a much better job than you. And so it's always remembering, what could I do today to resign as general manager of the universe so that I could allow what I'm supposed to be doing? And I fell in love with a prayer that I, when I was recovering from drug addiction 25 years ago, it was in the Alcoholics Anonymous big book, which was, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as thou will. Relieve me of the bondage of self so that I may better do thy will. I'm sure I'm not saying it right, but that phrase, to relieve me of the bondage of self.
Mm-hmm.
I love that. I love that. I used to be on my hands and knees every day for 5 years. Just use me. Relieve me of what I think I should be doing and allow the universe to use me for some greater cause. And I feel like today I am being used for that greater cause, and I love it.
That's a beautiful, beautiful message that I don't think we can hear too often. And I also love that phrase, resigning as general manager of the universe. Consider that as the title of your next book.
Exactly. Especially when it comes to getting a book on the New York Times list. I mean, it's you can't make it happen. If it's going to happen, it's because there's a lot of things lined up to make it happen. And how are you going to love yourself even if it doesn't happen?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I was leafing through this wonderful new book of yours, The Best Year of Your Life, and I really, in fact, how about telling us a little bit about that? Then I have a couple of very specific questions to ask you about how that book came to be, but why don't you tell everybody about that?
Well, The Best Year of Your Life is really about becoming the person that you desire to be. To, at the end of the year, not that you have attained your goals, because yes, I've had many years where I've attained everything I ever wanted in the material world, but was left feeling empty inside. But the years where I've worked on my inner world and I've had that balance between inner and outer, at the end of the year, if I've made good choices, if I've allowed myself to evolve, and if I've surrendered and I love who I am, then nothing else really matters. And that's what I see from teaching and being a trainer and training coaches, is that when you're loving your life, magic happens. And so the best year of your life, ultimately, even though it's called Dream It, Plan It, and Live It, and does give people those tools on how to make things happen in the outer world, really its point is, who would I have to be in the inner world to create effortlessly and easily with joy the things that will nourish me in the outer world? And maybe I don't even know what they are, because oftentimes the things we think we want aren't exactly what are going to bring us happiness.
Well, yes, and that really speaks to one of the questions I wanted to ask you about the best year of your life, and that is that one of the things that impresses me about it is it's so much about balance, about creating more openness in the inner world at the same time as you're manifesting your heart's desires in the outer world. And one of the things I was wondering about, I haven't seen you in a couple of months, I guess, and I wanted to find out a little bit about your life now, about how do you keep yourself in balance now? How are you able to practice the principles in the book, in the pressures and, you know, the busyness of your life?
Oh, I'd like to say that I'm a master at it, but, you know, they say you write what you need to learn. So, it's been a really hard lesson, and I think that's why I write about it so much, of really that balance. I mean, the great news is I have a 10-year-old that I love and love to be with, and so that really has me stay at home, where before I used to be on the road and I could drag him around. For the last 4 years, he doesn't want to go anywhere with me. He wants to stay. He doesn't even want to skip school. And so, and I got married this year, as you know, and really built the house of my dreams. I had an amazing year last year. And so now I feel like I'm drawing in. You know, I'm spending more time taking care of myself and seeing what I can let go of. And handing my business over to my coaches and my staff and changing a lot of things so that, because I feel like this year is really another inner year. And I see I go back and forth between the outer and the inner, and taking that time to do some yoga or meditate or just send some love. I feel like my work is all about having people go inside and go inside to find the answers. And I lead so many calls where I'm leading meditations, and I always do the work myself. And that, of course, gives me a balance that I could never get anywhere else if I wasn't doing that, because it's really part of my work.
That's one thing I really like about your work, is that, like I made a decision many years ago never to teach any principle that I hadn't found useful and valuable in practice myself, and you do the same thing. You actually do the work. And I think that's one of the things that gives your work a lot of power.
Well, I love it. And I know that when I first started on the spiritual path and being with teachers and seeing how insane a lot of them were, it was depressing. I went through a hard time once with a teacher who I really admired. And then I got into their inner life and was horrified. And so I think because of that experience, I believe that we don't have any experience that we're not meant to have and learn from, I really learned, and I said, I always want to be somebody that I can practice what I preach. And am I perfect? I'm not. And anybody who knows my work knows that I share a lot of my own process. In fact, I started blogging on the Best Year site, which is really great because I get to share, you know, my inner struggles. And I'm a human. And actually, I wouldn't give them up, because every time I have one, I learn from it. And I feel like I evolve and grow and have the opportunity to test out my work.
Beautifully said. Well, what do you think is, like, if people were going to take away a central idea of one practical step they could do to create the best year of their life, what's something that they could do?
Well, my favorite chapter, I think, is the chapter on fantasy. And what the chapter on fantasy does is it busts the fantasy that one day that you're waiting for, when I finally get on Oprah, when I finally finish my movie, when my husband finally starts treating me this way, when my child goes to college, when I finally have enough money. That one day fantasy, I feel, is what robs people of having the best year and creating, being responsible right here and now. There's nobody in the world that can make your life great but you. And so we're always giving up to that dream when this finally happens. And so the fantasy really busts that. But more importantly, it has you look and see, how are you going to feel when you finally reach that place? And I believe that feeling is what we're searching for. And the fantasy is just the soul's way of kind of showing you, telling you need something else. So for an example, I share in the book about when the book, when Dark Side made number one. My fantasy was that one day I would become number one. Well, after I became number one, I was depressed. Actually, I never even enjoyed it because I was so busy that, and I didn't even know what it meant to be number one on the New York Times list, to tell you the truth. I remember screaming, and then that was it. I forgot about the whole thing. I didn't understand it at the time. But afterwards, I went into a very dark time, and I remember being, I was leading a seminar, a shadow process at the Chopra Center, and Deepak and somebody else came over and to congratulate me, and they're like, well, how you doing? And I said, well, to be honest with you, I'm not doing that great. You know, I feel really sad. And what I realized is that I was searching for this fantasy and thought that when I got there, I would suddenly feel like I mattered.
And that was your fantasy, that that was the one that was going to do it for you.
Exactly. And then there was no fantasy, and I still, because I didn't know how to make myself matter to me, or I didn't really know how to acknowledge myself, and I realized after that, Kay, that I could just call Aunt Pearl. She would tell me that I mattered. Or my sister Ariel, she would tell me that I mattered, and that I needed to take that back and take responsibility and tell myself why I mattered. I was going too fast to matter in my own life. And so when I started doing that, so I distinguished the feeling and what I needed and started waking up every day and saying, what could I do to feel like I mattered or feel important or feel worthy today? And I just did it for 6 months. And at the end, I felt tremendous. And all of a sudden, there was nothing out there to chase. And so I tell people, if you're looking for respect, if you're looking for admiration, if you're looking for love, if you're looking to feel successful, how will you feel when you're successful? You know, you'll feel important or you'll feel worthy to start now. Give up. You're not going to find it out there. And I know you know this from working with a lot of people who are celebrities or that have a lot of money. Almost all of them go through this. Like, oh, my God, I finally got where I wanted to go, and I don't feel like I'm supposed to feel.
Yes, exactly. And I just wanted to put in a plug again for people on the call to be sure to go to bestyearofyourlife.com because it has some really wonderful things on it. And particularly I wanted to mention the blog that Debbie's writing, and I learned something about you that really made me chuckle because it's exactly what I do. You were mentioning in your blog that you have 50 sticky notes all over your car, your purse, your computer, your desk, and you write notes on the back of receipts and business cards. Well, one of the things that happens when I come back from a trip is I literally download all of the little sticky things and pieces of paper and everything that I got from my trip. And if you looked at my desk right now, you'd see little yellow stickies everywhere.
Yes, that's when I went after becoming radically organized and I realized that was one big sticky note.
Well, I hired an organizational person to come in a while back to help me out, and she took one look at my desk and she said, she kind of groaned and she said, oh no, you're one of the yellow sticky note people, you know. Why do you think it is that so many of us kind of sabotage ourselves when we're trying to achieve our goals and dreams, that we somehow get in our own way and even do that more than once? We become serial saboteurs, I guess you might say. So why do you think that is?
Well, the first thing that comes up to me is a quote that my friends Paul and Lane Cutright once said, the guilty seek punishment. And I feel, especially since I do so much shadow work, is that most people hold a lot of grudges and resentments, not only towards other people, but toward themselves. And that unforgiving nature that most humans have has us, it is the internal world we're beating ourselves up. And so the external world is always a mirror of our internal world. So people internally are beating themselves up, and then all of a sudden they wonder why they're doing things in the outer world to beat themselves up, because it's just a way to affirm those internal messages that most of us have, that we're not good enough or we'll never get what we want or whatever our programming is. And my new thing, Gay, which I think is, you know, if everybody could go out and do this, whenever, before I start leading a group, somewhere in the first hour, I ask everybody, how many of you have felt unworthy, you know, ugly, not good enough? Just give them one of those undeserving in the last 24 hours. Well, 90% of the people have had some thought like that. Mm. And I make them look around to see that those thoughts are not personal.
Yeah.
And that's always shocking because, you know, we think they're so personal. And so I think that we have to start with forgiving ourselves for being part of the human race and being a part of the collective unconscious where all of those thoughts live. And we have to forgive ourselves for being flawed, for being imperfect, for not doing it right, for not always behaving, for making choices that aren't in our highest and best interest. And really, the foundation of all my long-term trainings is self-forgiveness, because what I know is that if you can forgive yourself really internally and have compassion, like open-heartedness, toward that sweet, vulnerable child that lives inside of you, then you will create those kind of magical moments in the outer world, because that the outer world will reflect, and you won't want to sabotage yourself, and you'll be careful who you hang around and what you say you're going to do, because you become that precious to yourself.
One of the most important parts of that, I think, is something that you've addressed a lot in your work, and I actually think it's probably the most important thing that people can do at a certain stage of their lives, and that is handle projection. You talk a lot about projection, and it's such an important thing. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what you mean by it and how you work with projection.
I would love to, because that is my passion. So projection, I think the easiest way to describe it for anybody who doesn't know what it is, it's really the transference. It's transferring some part of yourself onto somebody in the outer world. And there's only one person in the world that we can't see if we have sight. Only one. And that person is ourselves. And so God created us so magically, just like the body functions so magically when it's working, so is our psyche. And we are designed in a way where the only way we can see ourselves is to look out there and to look at other people. And so if I want to know my light side, my best self, all I have to do is look in the outer world and look for who I love, who turns me on, who excites me, and distinguish the qualities that I'm seeing in them, and I will find my best expression of myself. And the same is true for my darkness. I can't see my own darkness, even though I think I can, but if I look out there and I see people that are angry or insensitive or rude or mean, again, I'm seeing myself. I'm seeing the disowned parts of myself. And I love Ken Wilber uses that expression, how do you know if something's a projection? And he says, when we are informed by somebody else, like we're just viewing it like information, somebody's qualities, somebody's behaviors, it's probably not a projection of our disowned self. But if we are affected in any way, like pointing our finger, blaming, going after it, you know, like that shouldn't be like that, or they're bad, or they're wrong, it's usually we're seeing a part of ourselves that we don't embrace and we don't own. And so the same thing, people do it with their light, with teachers. I always tell people, don't do it to me. I don't need your light. I have my own. But people say, oh, you're so brilliant, or you're so articulate. No, you're just seeing your own brilliance or your own way of articulating inside of me, your own creative self. And if we could all take back, I would say, take back ourselves from other people, then everybody becomes our peer. then we have the power to say, wow, I am seeing. So I'll give you an example how I learned this, because this is the foundation of my work, Gay, and this one single moment that I'm going to share with you changed my life radically. So I was on this, I had struggled with drug addiction until I was about 22 years old, which I don't want to say is almost, God, I don't know, 28 years ago or something. I feel that old, yes. So I'd been through a bunch of treatment centers, and then I decided that if I was going to have to live sober, I was going to do whatever I had to do to learn how to be happy and blissful in this life. So that sent me on a spiritual path, and I did everything. I did Sufism and Buddhism and hung crystals in my head and rebirthing and affirmation tapes. In fact, I would make tapes and put on that subliminal messaging that, you know, and sleep with it that said, I am loving, I am kind, I am warm. And then I'd wake up in the morning like angry and pissed off. No. And even though I was getting better and I was becoming nicer, actually Arielle was even talking to me at that point, because she didn't talk to me for years. I was just so angry. So my life was getting better, but when I got quiet in my meditation, because somehow my goal was I wanted to be able to sit out in the desert with no men, no food, no sugar, no cigarettes, no any substance, and love who I was. And after all this work, and I always say I spent 5 years and $50,000. Now, this is 30 years ago, so you can imagine how much money that would be today. Because it wasn't that much information out at the time, trying to heal myself, trying to find out what made me and why would I have had all these dark parts, because my sister always told me that I had a lot of darkness. So one day, after all this time, and I was doing much better, at the time I was in the retail business, I went to a leadership intensive with a woman named Jan Smith out of Atlanta. And there was only 20 people, most of them business people, and we had to stand up in front of the room and say what we were committed to in the world. So I was standing in front of the room, it became my turn, and I was very shocked, felt very embarrassed and shy, because these were all kind of CNN-type people. And I was saying what I was committed to was bringing self-esteem into the school system. So I'm standing up in front of these 20 people, everybody's staring at me, and from the back of this room, the woman screams out, "You're a bitch!" And I thought, well, I know that. How does she know? And I was horrified. It was the one thing I never, ever wanted anyone to say about me. And to find out, and I'd spent all this time and money really creating a new persona, learning how to talk in a spiritual voice. If I had something and you wanted it, I would give it to you. And here Jan is she's calling me a bitch, and I'm feeling humiliated and embarrassed. And so she asked me, what could be good about being a bitch? And I said, nothing. She goes, well, you're a bitch. There's got to be something good about it. Yeah. And so I couldn't find anything. And then she asked me a couple of questions. She said, let me ask you something. If you were remodeling a house and you were this many dollars over budget and 6 weeks late, which she knew that I was remodeling at the time, she said, do you think it would help you to be a little bitchy? And I remembered when I finally confronted the contractor and really got angry with him, he actually finished my house. So I said, yeah. And then I was a retailer. She goes, do you ever get damaged merchandise? And I said, yes. She said, do they ever not want to take it back? And I said, yes. And she says, does it help you when you become a little forceful or a little bitchy? And all of a sudden, Gabe, I had a cellular experience, I always say. I saw that this part of me that I had tried to get rid of, that I hated, that I thought was so horrible, actually came bearing some gifts. And I then understood all the things I had ever read, and I understood what Deepak Chopra was saying, that we're a microcosm of the macrocosm, and that we all have all these qualities, and I understood that there was good in something that I had thought was inherently bad. And suddenly I could own it in my inner world, and magically my outer world shifted. And that's what owning your projections will do. As you embrace it in your inner world, as you can make peace with these parts of yourself that I think it was Robert Bly that said we spend the first 20 years of our lives taking parts of ourselves and putting them in an invisible bag behind us, and then we have to spend the rest of our lives recollecting ourselves. But that's what projection allows us to do. It allows us to go out, find out what we're hating about our own humanity, make peace with it, find its gifts, allow it to integrate, and the same thing on the light side. At the same time, I could go see Marianne Williamson 20 years ago and be in awe at her and ask, what am I seeing in her? I'm seeing her confidence and her brilliance to be a spiritual leader, and that had me look inside myself. Well, where in that? How could I develop that and then become that myself?
Beautiful.
I know that was a long answer.
No, that's wonderful. Projection, though, is one of those things that it's kind of like one of the enduring challenges of life is to always be in the process of looking for where you've got something projected either on the dark side or the light side, and doing what the Tibetan Buddhists call friendly cannibalism, just seeing a projection and eating it, you know, kind of bringing it back into yourself. And I really appreciate your focus on that, because it's something that we really can't hear too much about. One of the things that we say in our work is how you know you're projecting is that listen to yourself complain, and anything you hear yourself complain about three or more times is sure to be a projection.
Can I just tell you about one of my projections while you're saying that? It's so great. In relationship, right?
Yeah.
But I was in Atlanta a couple of years ago at my stepsister's, and I heard myself talking about my mother.
Uh-huh.
And I could just keep, you know, my mother, right? I kept talking about her and listening, observing myself. You're gossiping, and that's, I think, another way to really know that you're projecting is you're gossiping. And I was thinking that, even as I was observing it, Gay, I was doing it. And then it was about, I was telling my stepsister that my mother talked to my stepfather in a particular way that really drove me nuts, which I thought was just very disrespectful. Here I am, no more than an hour later, I'm in my son was with me, and at the time he was only two or three. I am having him brush his teeth, and I hear that same tone come out of my mouth.
Oh, isn't that an amazing moment when you hear that same thing? I know one day when I heard myself saying something to my daughter that was exactly the same tone that used to drive me crazy when my mother used it.
Oh, and you feel it in your body, right? You're like horrified that that's actually you. That's how you really know you're getting some good shadows. You're like repulsed.
Yeah, the power of it is. I know you've spoken about so much in your books, though, is you get this incredible creative power from owning your projections. You know, the moment you reach out and embrace them with love, you really harness that power and can ride it to a different level in your life.
I love that. And if people knew what they would get out of owning their dark projection, because really it's freedom.
Yeah.
It is freedom.
Yeah, and that beautiful phrase that you use, standing in your power, you know, that's really what it's all about. In fact, take a minute to talk a little bit about what you mean by standing in your power and the gift of doing that.
Well, when you said that, I just see being aligned with the highest parts of yourself and knowing both your humanity and your divinity, because even though we are living a human experience, we are divine beings. And I feel like when I'm standing in my power, I feel like I'm just being true to myself, to my highest self, and I'm embracing all of myself, even my lowest self. And it's such a how do you know you're standing in your power? You're empowered. You don't want for anything. You're not wishing, comparing yourself to other people. You're happy to be who you are. We are designed that way. That's why I love leading transformation, is because people think I'm a genius, but really I don't have to do anything. All I have to do is support people in getting reconnected with all of themselves, and they will stand in their power. They'll be awed and wowed by their own self. And we all have that. And I love the analogy of, you know, that we're like these great pieces of art. and a sculptor would look at a piece of stone, and they can see the magnificence in it. They know what the creation is, so all they have to do is chisel away anything that's not that, and there they are. They have a masterpiece, and that's all we have to do. We don't have to become anything. We already are everything that we ever wanted to be, and we just have to chisel away anything that is distracting us or blocking us from seeing that self. And then, voila, we wind up in our power naturally. And is it work? It is, right, Gay? It's work.
Well, yeah, especially you mentioned drug addictions and that kind of thing. I remember just like 30 years ago, I was a heavy smoker. Everybody in my family smoked. And, I mean, it was sort of unthinkable not to smoke in my family growing up. And but I remember when I was about maybe 25 or something like that, quitting smoking. And I felt like I was turning my body inside out or something. It felt like I was birthing a whole different cellular structure in me. And that's tough work, you know, like on about the third day of kicking some drug like tobacco or that kind of thing. Boy, it gets to be down to where you really are called on to practice what you preach.
Yeah, and I have to say that I was also a smoker back then, that cigarettes was actually harder to kick than drugs.
Well, that's what I found, too. And I've had actual heroin addicts tell me the same thing, that it was harder for them to get off cigarettes. And actually, one of them told me it was harder to get off cigarettes and refined sugar than it was to kick heroin.
I think so, because the heroin, you know that it's going to kill you. I mean, that's the denial mechanism that we have. You know, it usually has to be so bad for us to surrender, to give up, to... And I think what I love about that process is that most people have to find God or spirit or some source bigger than themselves to overcome addiction. And I feel that's why we have addiction.
Yeah, it's kind of a substitute for divinity.
It is. And I think that the most spiritual people I know and some of the most creative are people that struggle with whether it's food addictions or cigarettes or drugs.
Exactly. And, well, one of the things that I think gives you a lot of your power and mastery as a teacher, as well as a writer, is that you're really open to sharing your own experience. And I think that that's one of the biggest gifts you give people, is when you reach down inside yourself and freely share that part of yourself that has struggled. You know, it's not like you're telling people what to do. It's you're broadcasting the possibility just by your very being.
Thank you. Thank you. I always share my stuff. I don't know. I always had a big mouth. I still have a big mouth. So now I just share about my own. Because I figure it's like my brother would say, wow, Debbie, if you can do it, anybody can do it. And I really feel like that, because I was somebody who really I was born discontent. I was born one of those people that was just always had an issue, always had some problem, some struggle. And I feel like when I look back, I'm like, I had the perfect recipe, because if I hadn't struggled with feeling ugly, feeling stupid, I had Arielle as my sister. She was, everybody looked up to her. She was the wow at everybody. And I was like the little scrawny little sister that wasn't quite as smart as her. So it was, I had all the perfect incidents, and I know that if you're listening and you want to live your dream, you wouldn't have a dream if you couldn't live it. And just to be able to distinguish, right, between our heart's desires and our ego's desires.
One of the things that I really appreciate from having been around you and Arielle is how well you get along as sisters. And actually, I must confess to a bit of envy there, because I don't get along that well with my brother. When I see you and Arielle interacting together, I really appreciate how well you do that. And I guess I hadn't really heard until this conversation we're having right now that there had been a time in your lives when you had a lot of struggle between you.
Yeah, I would say from the day I was born till I was about 24.
Uh-huh.
That And I would say there was maybe 5 years that we barely even spoke, if you can imagine that. And now she's my agent, my manager. She was the one that when I was started teaching shadow work, she said to me, she leaned over, I remember where we were at Sammy's Pizza Kitchen, and she said, if you write the book, I'll do everything else.
Wow, that is so beautiful. That's one thing I really appreciate about your relationship, how for each other you are. You know, like I've heard Arielle speak about you, you know, literally dozens of times, and I've only heard her say totally positive things about you, supportive things. And it's so rare to be around a sibling to hear that kind of thing. And so anyway, I just wanted to honor you for that, because it's something that's quite rare, I think, in life, to do that amount of work on yourself to get to the place where you can be that at ease with your siblings.
That is true, and we both did it. But she's a incredible human being, as you know, and I'm blessed to have her. She's definitely an earth angel, even though she looked like my biggest nightmare for most of my life. And that's really shadow work, right? It was only from her doing deep work and me doing deep work that we could take back our projections. And that's what's so interesting about love, and I know you teach this, so you know better than anybody, is that the person that you love one minute, you can hate the next. And all it is projection. And if people understood that projection is a trance, it's actually you go into a trance when you have a disowned part of yourself energetically. And so you're sure the other person is that way. And so if we're willing to do our own work, and I get just, I have stories that would literally blow people's minds of people. I had a woman recently who, she's an exec at B&A, and she said, she came to the shadow process. She embraced everything she hated about her boss, who hated her, by the way, and who was really giving her a hard time. And she went back, and now she's coaching her boss.
Wow.
And she's not coaching her boss because she made herself better. She's coaching her boss because she embraced that she was a mean, aggressive, you know, opportunist. And she made peace with it. So now her boss can't project that. That's the great thing. You know, if somebody's projecting on you, it's because you have a hook. So to not just say, oh, it's just their stuff, but what hook do I have in that they can hook into?
That's what I always tell my students, too, is whenever somebody criticizes you or finds fault or accuses you of something, the fastest thing you can do to get the lesson of it is to cheerfully agree with it and just say, yeah, that's part of me, too.
Oh, I have to tell you my Beau story. Okay, Beau's 10 years old. I pick him up from school less than a week ago. He's never used this language. He says, Mommy, I'm using one of your life lessons. I've never heard of life lessons. I'm like, oh, really, Beau? What are you using? He goes, well, today so-and-so called me stupid. And I said, oh, really? He says, yeah. He said, and I said, yeah, I'm stupid. And then the kid said, hey, everybody, Beau just called himself stupid. And so Beau looked at him and he said, so what's the point? And he said, and then the kid went away.
Wow. Well, I think you have a budding Zen master there in the household. He sounds like a keeper.
He is an angel.
Yeah. I don't think I've had the pleasure of meeting Beau yet. Maybe on one of my trips down south your way, you can introduce him to me.
I will. I will definitely do that.
One of the things that also I resonate with in your work is that, you had a book called The Right Questions. It's the emphasis, though, on getting yourself shifted over from asking the wrong kind of questions that we kind of obsess about to asking the right kind of questions. And I wonder if you could say a little bit about that, because that's such a key part of what I think it takes to be a successful human being, is asking the right questions.
Well, I was fortunate enough, although I didn't always believe this way, to have a father who was a judge. I don't know if you know that about
him. No, I did not.
Yes. We had a father who was a judge for 18 years. And my father always gave me consequences. Like, you could do this or you could do that. And showed me the negative consequences of my behavior. Now, you have to remember, I was a pretty wild person. But what I realized is that I got this enormous gift from that. And the gift was that I can see the positive and the negative. I can see positive consequences and negative consequences. So the right questions I've always used, because people always used to ask me, well, how do you seem to manifest everything you want? And I was like, well, I ask myself these questions to make sure I'm going in the direction I want to go. So for an example, a right question would be, will this choice propel me toward an inspiring future, or will it keep me stuck in the past? So and not everybody's like this. I think half the people in the world are like this, is I am driven by the negative, not the positive.
Mm-hmm.
So if I know something's going to propel me toward an inspiring future, that doesn't really do it for me. But if I know something will keep me stuck in the past, I don't want to stay stuck in the past, so then I'll make the right choice. Or will this choice bring me long-term fulfillment, or will it bring me short-term gratification? Well, I may not really be looking like long-term fulfillment, but I know the cost of short-term gratification. I know it will rob me of my dreams, and I'm not interested in that. So then I'll make that. So being able to, like, am I standing in my power? I'm trying to please another. I am just inherently a people pleaser. I will go for getting love before saying my truth. So that question's been very important to me, because I've sold my soul too many times to make somebody else happy and given my power away instead of standing for my truth. So I love this thought of, you know, being able to see the positive and negative consequences. I use it on Beau, even, or in a relationship. Am I looking for what's right, or am I looking for what's wrong? My natural tendency would be to look for what's wrong, but if I notice that's what I'm doing, then I can shift right into, instead I'm going to look for what's right. And I think that to get where we want to go, we have to make sure that we are asking the right questions and that we're heading in the direction. Because so many people seem to just keep repeating the past over and over, making the same kind of choices. And as you know, who we are today is a result of the choices that we made yesterday and last month and last year and 5 years from now. And so if we want a future unlike we're going to have today, we've got to ask new questions and make sure that we're making new choices that empower us.
One of the things that I learned from reading some books about Albert Einstein was how he was in the habit of asking questions that really didn't have a right answer. And I started using that a lot in my work, and started calling them wonder questions. Like a question, you know, a lot of people ask kind of closed questions like, oh, what's wrong with me? Or what's wrong with the world? Or something like that. But a wonder question has no answer. You know, it's like, how can I be my best today? It allows things to unfold. And I was really pleased to, when I ran across these books about Einstein, that he was in the habit of doing the same thing. He kind of, what he called, live in questions, you know, to open up questions and then let the universe kind of provide the answers to them.
Well, I love that, and I think that's a great process for people to do, to look at how many, because I think you're right, how many questions are going nowhere. And, you know, is that quest, the way you question yourself, is it empowering you or disempowering you? And I think that when we're not open, that it is very disempowering and disrespectful to ourselves. And then, of course, we self-sabotage and make ourselves right that the world doesn't respect us, because we're not really respecting our internal world and our internal power.
That's really true. Well, one of the things that I'm really enjoying about this conversation is I'm seeing so many different crossing points of how your work and our work intersects with each other, and that always makes me happy when I see those kind of connections coming out. Is there something that you could, that you've always wanted to kind of learn about or look at, or anything that's kind of your leading edge right now, anything that's coming up for you that you're really moving toward that you'd like to talk about?
Well, I think what I'm writing a new book, and so I'm just, actually my new book is really about man's self-sabotage. It's it's really looking at why we do bad things. So I am just, I'm fascinated with the human psyche and the human just brain and why we do the things we do and that blueprint and how to alter that internal blueprint and add in new software that empowers us and drives us. And I feel like anything I can learn about the holographic brain and our connection to the collective unconscious is just so inspiring to me.
So you're really looking into this whole area of self-sabotage more deeply that you've touched on in other works of yours.
Yeah, I'm just going into the shadow at a whole new level, more maybe more of a commercial book, like why good people do bad things, like why the Bill Clinton, you know, why sabotage at that level, the Martha Stewart, the Michael Jackson, just that just deep, you know, and all of us do it in our own way. Those are just very big, clear examples, and that mechanism of, you know, how can we assure ourselves that we're not going to go down that tunnel?
Yeah, one of the things that seems to me about human beings is that, you know, we've had centuries and centuries of dealing with adversity, and so we have a lot of skills available for dealing with adversity and probably even neurological wiring for dealing with adversity, but we don't have very much experience yet with handling things going right for very long.
Isn't that interesting? I see that too, and I see that it's just like it's that old belief that I think is part of the collective, and it, you know, watch out because the shoe's going to drop, or I'll just keep myself down here because if I get too high, the fall is so much harder. And we live in a world where everybody is projecting their darkness, so people are just waiting. They're hungry for you to get killed when you're at the top. And so I think that all of that is really frightening, and that's why we have to find that security within our own self, within our own soul, so that we can handle what happens in the outer world and when people turn on us. Because people will turn on you. I mean, it's just, I know that people are always coming thinking like if they change enough, they can change, and I have a little bit of delusion in that area too. You can change what could happen if you go out in the world in a new way, whether it's in your family, because some people just do it in their family. Like to win in their family is so scary that their mother's going to hate them, or their father, or their sister if they have more money. And so I think that we've given so much power to the outer world, and that we have to learn how to really become secure, that safety only lives internally. Like, if I don't beat myself up, then I'm safe. But if I'm going to beat myself up because somebody turns on me or betrays me or I make a mistake or they're going to laugh at me, then there is no safety.
Well, that's really true. I was just remembering watching when Bill Clinton, you mentioned him, when he was first nominated, and at the time there had been three or four other major candidates, and he kind of came out of the pack there and became number one. And one of my elderly therapy mentors, who was about 76, 77 years old at the time, was watching the nominations there with me, and he said, "Oh, he's a bad boy. He's a bad boy. He's going to have to get in trouble to see if people will still love him." And
wow.
Later on, I really looked back at that moment and said, "Wow, it was so obvious," you know, on his to my mentor, and I hadn't even noticed that, you know, and that's the benefit, I guess, of being a therapist for 50 or 60 years, is you get a little more perceptive about that kind of thing.
Yeah, and you can feel it, and you can, I mean, I see it all the time with people, like they're going down the wrong road, and I'm fascinated with that mechanism of denial, and I know we're designed with that mechanism, we need it, and that's why we can't see ourselves, but I'm just fascinated, like, what has to happen to penetrate the denial, not just the big denials, but even the little ones of how we're showing up in our relationships, how we show up to the people that work for us, or, you know, our mailmen. And most of us just are clueless because we can't see ourselves about the cost of our behavior.
That is so true. Well, I'm really eager to see anything you... this particular subject is one that's very dear to my heart also, and so I'll be very interested to see how you come along with that and what we can do to support that getting out in the world. One of the things that Healthy and Wealthy and Wise is that we believe strongly in the power of intention to manifest outcomes. So what is your current most important project, and what intention would you like us at Healthy, Wealthy, and Wise, as well as our listeners and readers, to hold for you right now, Debbie?
Well, I love that question. That is so beautiful.
Isn't that a beautiful idea?
It's such a beautiful idea, and I, too, believe in the power of intention. Well, I decided this year that I was ready to go out in the world in the next biggest evolution of myself, whatever that is. I'm not quite sure if it's going to be radio or TV, so maybe the intention could be, one, for me to get clear, is it radio or TV, and then to allow that manifestation of whatever will be in the highest and best interest for myself, for my family, for the universe to unfold this year.
So good. Well, thank you. So you'd like to have clarity come to you about the correct path, the right path, the best feeling path for you to express yourself more through either radio or television or some other medium that feels congenial to you.
Yes.
Well, good. Let's just all take a breath of holding that intention for Debbie to... We got 1,000 people from all over the world here with you, so let's just all be with that for a moment and support that intention for Debbie. So we'll check back in with you maybe 6 months or a year and find out how all of that is moving along.
Great. Thank you. I love that.
So one thing as we kind of move toward closing here, we'd like to focus in a little bit on if there was a single idea or one central technique or central concept that you'd like us to come away with today, what would that central concept or idea or technique be that you'd really like us to take away from this conversation today?
That's a big question. But I think that I'm almost embarrassed to say it because it sounds so simple, but I know that it works, is that if all of us collectively each day could focus on how could you bring more love to your own self today, and that if everybody would try this for 28 days, just to wake up in the morning and see what could you do today to love yourself more, to forgive yourself more, to be more compassionate for one of your flaws or imperfections, I am clear that that will not only change your life, but change the lives of everybody you touch.
So to develop a practice of maybe opening each day or sometime during the day of really asking yourself how you could let more love circulate through your life.
Yeah, love that.
Mm-hmm.
Love that. And I know that that's how we take back our projections. When we're feeling safe, it's okay to admit that we're stupid or feel unimportant or unworthy or insensitive. We don't always have to defend and push back and project, which is what causes all the angst and anger and, I believe, wars and unrest in our world.
I was talking to a young fellow the other day who's 20 that had just come out of basic training in the Army. And I was asking him how many people graduated from his little troop or platoon, which was a couple hundred people in his. And he said that all but about 6 or 7 got out of basic training. And I said, well, what did the 6 people get? They make it. And he said, he never thought about this before, but he said, you know, every single one of them, they couldn't take even the most constructive criticism. Like if they were just being told something that was useful, it wasn't critical at all, they would argue with it. And I thought to myself, boy, I know that space. I've been there before in my life.
Isn't that the truth? And, you know, when we're loving ourselves, we could be like Bo and say, okay, I'm stupid. What's the point? All right. You know, I'm not a good cook. What's the point?
Gosh, that has been one of the most wonderful quotes to come out of this conversation for me. I'm going to quote Bo. Have to ask his permission, I guess, but I want to quote him. That's one of the best things I've heard in a long time. I'm stupid, so what's the point?
Yeah, like, what is the problem with that? I love that. I love that. And if we could all, you know, when we're loving ourselves, we just, it's okay, right? It's like, okay, people are going to hate us. People are going to try to block us. People aren't always going to give us what we want or meet our expectations, and we can just surrender.
That's beautiful. Well, that's one thing I really got a lot of value out of in this conversation. Another thing which I always really like to hear about and got a lot of value out in the conversation was your emphasis on projection, on when you see things out there in the world that you find yourself complaining about or obsessing about or looking at critically or judgmentally, to kind of benignly, lovingly bring that attention back to yourself and kind of say, what part of me is that reflecting? So I really appreciate you bringing projection out into the world for us in such an eloquent way.
Oh, it is my passion, so you can count on me to do it till the day they have to put me under. I feel like I got it in such a huge way, and what a great gift to give yourself is to take back your projections, not just your negative ones, but your positive ones as well.
I totally agree. I remember one day I was in the audience listening to a guru many years ago, Krishnamurti, and I had this little thought flash through my mind of owning the projection, and the little thought was, boy, it's better to be one than to see one, meaning a guru.
And I love that, and look at you.
Yeah.
I could sit at your feet, absolutely.
So I really also appreciate and want to salute that incredible, passionate attention you give to the shadow, to making sure we acknowledge and own all of those things about ourselves that we sometimes tend to criticize about ourselves, to open our embrace to that too, to open your embrace of your inner world at the same time as you make progress in the outer world. I think that's something that I've come away from this conversation feeling even more grounded in since I've talked to you here.
Well, thank you, Gay. You are one of my inspirations, so I am just totally honored and thrilled to have you interview me and to be a part of this community.
Well, blessings to you. And I really appreciate it. I think I'm coming down your way later on in the week. Maybe I'll even cross paths to you. I'm going to go down and have a meeting with Deepak, so I'm going to be in your neighborhood on Friday anyway, and your sister, too, by the way.
Oh, great. So maybe I can kidnap you for a little while.
Yeah. Well, blessings to you, and thank you so much for joining us today. And I'd like to turn things back over to our Master of Ceremonies here, Janet.
And so, both of you, thank you so much. What an honor to be able to just sit here and absorb the depth of wisdom that you both have. I think it's so profound, Debbie and Gay, that here I am in India meeting all kinds of masters and gurus for my current project, and I'm still sitting at the feet of two masters this morning, so thank you. I truly, truly mean that. You know, all I continue to absorb in India as I've been here over the past year, off and on, is the knowledge that, you know, to truly be happy, one has to just go within and know thyself. And both of you clearly are masters of that, so thank you so much. It's just, Gay, what a treat to have you as our co-host, and Debbie, how deeply profound, what an honor it is to have both of you with us again. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Janet and Chris, for creating.
And I Oh, I truly mean that. I can't wait to come back to the U.S. and get to know both of you. So I'm setting that intention that I'll have that time to sit with both of you and we can all share. So it's just going to be really, really fun. I look forward to that. So for all of our listeners, be sure to find out how to create the best year of your life by getting a copy of Debbie's latest book, The Best Year of Your Life, at www.debbieford, that's D-E-B-B-I-E, ford.com. And is there, I have this question to all of you, is there any reason why this year shouldn't be your best year ever? And we all know the answer is absolutely not. And Debbie's book will show you how to dream it, plan it, and live it. So go now to debbieford.com and begin creating the best year you've ever had. And Debbie, I absolutely want a copy of that book, and I'm very excited to read it. So for all of you, be sure to join us in 2 weeks on June 24th when we will be interviewing an amazing Canadian, a dear friend of mine, Raymond Arend. He's the co-author of Chicken Soup for the Canadian Soul, and he's been guiding people to great wealth for more than two decades. This year, he's speaking around the country with people like Tony Robbins, Donald Trump, and Robert Kiyosaki. Then on July 5th, we will interview David Lynch, the acclaimed writer, director of Twin Peaks, Mulholland Drive, The Elephant Man, and Blue Velvet, among others. Later in July, we go back to Financial Passions with Stephen Pierce, the phenomenally successful editor of Impulsive Profits, the commodity training advisory newsletter, who has also become a legend in internet marketing with his e-book, The Whole Truth. In early August, Stephen Simon of Spiritual Cinema Circle, and Debbie, I know he's probably a dear friend of yours, as he works so closely with Ariel and Gay. He'll join us again as our co-host to interview some of his Academy Award-winning writer and director friends. And in September, we have the joy and privilege to interview one of my main mentors, Byron Katie, the best-selling author of Loving What Is, and her most recent book, I Need Your Love, Is That True? So it's an incredible lineup. We look forward to having all of you with us again and again and again. And again, Gay and Debbie, just incredible evening being with you. And thank you, everyone, for joining us. Good night to all of you, and good morning to anyone else who's on the phone in Delhi, India. Okay, so good night, everyone.
Good night, everyone.
Good night. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.